KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, author Christopher Buckley joins us in studio to discuss his most recent satiric novel, Supreme Courtship, and we'll talk with him about his views on both of the main political parties and the political world of Washington, D.C. That's next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's Forum program. Christopher Buckley is the author of 13 books, and he's also editor-at-large of Forbes Life magazine. He is the recipient of both the Thurber Prize for American Humor and the Washington Irving Prize for Literary Excellence. And his most recent book, in which the President of the United States nominates America's most popular TV judge to the Supreme Court, is called Supreme Courtship. Author Tom Wolfe calls him one of the funniest writers in the English language, and he is, of course, a scion to the great William Buckley and joins us for this Forum Hour. And delighted to have you. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael. Good to be here.
Well, where do we begin? You know, I want to talk about your novel.
Do we begin? Let's talk about the book.
But before we do that, sure. I want to talk politics with you because I read your pieces, was delighted by them, as I'm sure many of our listeners were, about the conventions and the schedules of the conventions.
Right, right.
And it ties in with the fact that you have been pretty much well, equal opportunity in terms of who you satire, who you satirize. Targets are no matter, right?
It's a target-rich environment. My instincts are probably conservative, but I attack in generally in all directions. As my dad would have said, mutatis mutandis. It's a little bit like what Woody Allen said about being bisexual. It doubles your chances of a date on Saturday night.
Well, and there's certainly no dearth of things to satirize on both sides of the aisle.
There's a lot to talk about these days. Yeah, there sure is.
But you still consider yourself a conservative, but you've kind of hit the Republican Party in print.
Pretty hard, yeah. Well, the piece you're alluding to was a Times op-ed piece and in the form of the, the convention schedule. And for instance, you know, in all political conventions have that sort of hokey thing of the theme of the day. You know, it's usually, you know, strength through diversity or, you know, toward a brighter tomorrow, you know. And so for the Republican convention, the theme of the first day I had is a black man in the White House. Can we talk? And the second day, I think, was wind power. Please. The third day was deficits, schmeficits. And the fourth day, I think the theme was peace through fear.
That's some very funny stuff.
I tend to sort of, I don't know, I kind of enjoy poking fun at my old, once beloved Republican Party a little bit more. It's a world I know better. I mean, I grew up in it, so I know it somewhat more intimately. But I like to throw a punch at the lefties, too, every now
and
then.
We'll talk about that, too. You also poke fun, though, talk about your background at, you know, the kind of, oh, I suppose Hyannisport, patrician world.
No. That's the other family, Hyannisport. I grew up in Stamford, Connecticut.
But that's the world you're associated with because of your father, of course. You know,
well, I grew up
patrician the American intelligentsia and the wealthy.
Not Kennedy wealthy. No. My great grandfather was sheriff of Duval County, Texas, which was the poorest county in Texas. My grandfather was a independent oil man in Mexico around the turn of the century. So we're not.
You're not aristocrats.
I remember my dad being surprised when my dad informed me that I said, "Oh, well, we're upper class, right?" He said, "Oh, no. We're middle class." I said, "Oh," I was somewhat dismayed to hear this.
But you also wrote an essay. It was a talk in which you said the Republican Party has really failed its faithful mission to conservatism. It was very, very strong.
Oh,
rhetorical.
I think absolutely, yeah. I wrote a piece for the Washington Monthly, which is a liberal, a venerable liberal magazine a couple of years ago that got me in a lot of trouble with my Republican friends, in which I said I hoped we would lose the upcoming elections because I thought the Republican Party had covered itself mainly with disgrace these last years. As McCain has said, we came here to change Washington, and Washington changed us. Well, I think I don't have to worry about that this coming November. After reading this morning's newspapers, I have come to the conclusion that Obama has won this election, and I would not be surprised if he won it decisively.
And you say that based on?
It's based on what's going on Wall Street. And 81%, according to the polls, 81% of the American people think the country is headed in a wrong direction.
But the polls are still running pretty close between these two.
Well, as of now, although the Palin effect, if you want to call it that, is wearing off. In most polls, Obama is running about 5 points ahead. But I think what's going on now on Wall Street, according to the Financial Times, this is the worst financial crisis the country has been in since 1929. So I think George Bush is going to be seen as Herbert Hoover too. And I don't know how you the idea that the country would elect a Republican president in a crashing economy.
Doesn't know much about economics.
Who has said and clearly doesn't, because his McCain, look, I didn't come on the show to just bash McCain, but the fact of the matter is his positions are all over the map. I mean, he changes his position now, you know, twice a day. It's quite clear he doesn't have a clue. Now, there's a lot. This isn't an entirely Republican manufactured crisis. There's a lot of partisan blame to spread around, but the fact of the matter is it's happening on Bush's watch. So my prediction, and I'm not particularly in the political prediction business, but as of this morning, I am convinced that this is Obama's, and I would not be surprised if he wins handily.
Well, I must tell you, when you mention the Palin effect, it makes me think of your novel, and there's an interesting segue.
Ah, well, I was hoping you'd bring up Supreme Courtship, the novel.
Let me say why. There is a president who is presented here from my home state in Ohio who pretty much is mostly interested in bowling more than anything else, which, interestingly enough, made me think of former mayor of Cleveland, Ralph Perk, who turned down an invitation to the White House because it was his bowling night. That's actually a fact.
I did not know that.
Wonderful synchronicities.
Life imitates. Sorry.
But it did in the sense that he nominates, of course, the premise, which is very funny, of Chris's new novel is that he has difficulty getting confirmation for those he wants to nominate to the high court, and so he nominates a kind of Judge Judy, although she's very much her own character, not like Judge Judy, a top popular TV judge. And he kind of is infatuated with her. And a lot of people thought that maybe McCain was a little bit infatuated with Sarah Palin.
Well, I tell you, the premise of the book is simply that, here's this I went out on a limb had as my president in this novel an actual nice guy. Typically in Washington novels, they're evil, they're cheating on their wives, they're in the receiving secret payments from Tashkent or something. No, he's a lovely, nice, decent guy from Ohio, because on the grounds that everyone from Ohio is nice. So he's trying to do the right thing, but he's continually thwarted by the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, who hates the president for various reasons. And so he keeps sabotaging his Supreme Court nominations. And finally, so one night, the president goes off in a bit of a huff to Camp David, and he's in bed with the first golden retriever named Dwight. And they're flicking through their channel surfing, looking for the bowling tournament. And on comes this show. It's called Courtroom Six, and it's hosted by this sort of very dishy lady.
Firecracker.
Her name Pepper Cartwright. And she's just sexy, and it's one of the top 10 rated shows in the country. And so the president thinks, okay, Buster, let's see you turn her down. So I give you, Michael, a book that I turned in January, where the two antagonists are a cosmetically enhanced U.S. senator who has run for president several times and who can't stop talking, pitted against a glasses-wearing, gun-toting TV hottie. I would like to take this opportunity to announce my resignation from satire. I give up.
This is a man who obviously should be in the prescience business rather than writing satire. I want to talk more about the novel, but let's talk about satire because, you know, your satire is funny, some very funny stuff here. In fact, in the confirmation process, some of that, as well as the Supreme Court cases that you invent, you take aim at many targets, and your kind of iconoclasm, I would almost characterize it as. But at the same time, as satire is often, or is often true about satire, there's some pretty serious motifs underlying this, like talking about just how things go in Washington and how they don't go in Washington. The confirmation process is something you're kind of tweaking here, too, and taking a twist at, aren't you?
Oh, sure. I think part of the reason I wrote a book about the Supreme Court where these, having watched a number of these confirmation hearings, which have devolved into a kind of kabuki dance, you know, in the wake of the Robert Bork and the Clarence Thomas hearings, which were, you know, kind of like, almost like O.J. Simpson trials. So they've now become very sort of subdued, hushed affairs where the nominees, who are typically, you know, brilliant jurists, pretend not to have strong opinions about anything. And you have the senators, on the other hand, who are pretending that they have no partisan axe to grind, you know, and that they do not deploy litmus tests, try to trap them into saying something interesting. And, you know, the Alito hearings and the Roberts hearings were really devoid of passion. The one passionate moment came when poor Mrs. Alito burst into tears when Senator Kennedy was trying to imply that Samuel Alito was wearing the Ku Klux Klan robe under his JCPenney suit. But so they've become, you know, they've become a form of theater in themselves, I think.
Overlaid with popular culture, as you suggest.
And sure, yeah.
Even the Alito example that you use. Yesterday I had occasion to interview Philip Roth for a broadcast, which will go on the air later on next month probably. But he wrote a famous essay in which he said American life almost defies the possibility of writing satire because the things that happen you can't make up.
I'm with him. I what I said a moment ago about resigning from satire. Do you remember what Yogi Berra memorably said when he was informed that a Jewish woman had been elected mayor of Dublin? Only in America.
We're talking with Chris Buckley, whose books include, by the way, The White House Mess, Wet Work, Thank You for Smoking, excuse me, and he's former chief speechwriter for George H.W. Bush, whom you have almost all good things to say about.
I love George Herbert Walker Bush. He was one of the kindest, most decent human beings I know. I was his speechwriter when he was vice president, you know, early on, and back in the 80s would seem a very long time ago. I think what has gone on must be terribly, terribly painful to this very decent guy. You know, to watch what's happened during his son's.
You're talking about tenure. Iraq. You're talking about the financial debacles.
I'm talking about sort of everything.
Everything.
You know, I mean, you probably interviewed Bob Woodward when his last book came out called State of Denial, but it was in that book that there was that galvanizing moment where Woodward is interviewing the current Bush in the White House, and he asks him if he had consulted his father before invading Iraq, and Bush replied, no, he had consulted a higher father. the mind boggles.
You think maybe that Maureen Dowd is onto something when she writes about all this Oedipal stuff going on between father and son?
Well, I try not to do the armchair psychoanalysis, but I think there is probably a component of that. I mean, if you read the biographies and you read the histories of these two, he's always been competitive with his father, and I think there may have been an element of, you know, I'm going to finish the job that Dad did. And I confess to you, Michael, that I was among, you know, the many people in back in '91 who thought, gosh, George Herbert Walker Bush, then president, should have finished the job, you know, and gone all the way to Baghdad. And now I think we see how prudent he was not to have done that.
Well, to this day, I claim, as I did in print and book I published, that I think George Herbert Walker Bush chose Dan Quayle because he was like a surrogate son. He reminds me of Bush Jr.
Well,
in so many ways.
As a matter of fact, that's probably a piquant point there. I hadn't thought of that, but yeah, they're a little bit similar.
Same fraternity. There's one of those interesting facts that you love to do.
Like, were they in Deke?
Like the guy who has the most. They were both Deeks. Ends in Washington. You get those kind of the advisor in your novel.
This is a many layered artichoke.
was Dexter Mitchell? Did you have Senator Biden in mind with Dexter?
He's
Mitchell?
Absolutely,
yeah.
Joe Biden.
Yeah.
Whom you kindly called me prescient, but I had no idea that Joe Biden would be a vice presidential candidate a year ago. He's a guy. I kind of like Biden. He's
likable.
He's likable. He's a sort of what you see is what you get. There's absolutely no filter between his brain and his mouth, and he has this serial ability to embarrass himself. Just the other day, he was on a stage at a fundraiser and pointed to a state senator who was in a wheelchair, permanently paralyzed, and said, "Come on, stand up. You know, let everyone see you." And then he recovered well, though. Yeah, he said, "Oh, God, love you. You know, yeah. We're the ones who should be standing up."
He asked everybody to stand up.
Yeah, right? You know, and, you know, saying as he did that that Obama should have picked Hillary as a running mate, that she would have been a better choice. So I look forward to the debate on October 2nd between Biden and Palin.
It's going to be interesting from many vantage points, but a lot of what you go after in your book is the kind of PC stuff, like a guy being questioned to be the Supreme Court justice and being revealed in the questioning that at the age of 12 he had a tepid book review of To Kill a Mockingbird. I mean, the kind of thing we're going to see in the vice presidential debate, and tell me if you'd agree with this, I think, is Biden probably tiptoeing around, because if he gets too aggressive, then, you know, he's going to be called a sexist.
Yeah, exactly. I was trying to think what I would, if I were one of Biden's handlers, how I would advise him on this. And the only thing I can think of is to just pretend she's not there. Just, you know, look at the camera and keep the answers relatively short. It's tricky because if he's too aggressive, exactly, he'll be seen as condescending. My dad, you know, many years ago, back in, it was probably the days of the Vietnam War, declined an opportunity to debate Jane Fonda. And I said to him, "Gosh, Pop, you know, why? You could, you know, carve her up into 100 pieces." And he said, no. He said, "Never debate with an amateur. They'll kill you every time." That comment stuck with me. I mean, I'm not calling her a total amateur. I mean, for heaven's sake, she's governor of Alaska. She's been in debates. But, you know, Biden is a highly, highly accomplished debater. So he may face a little bit that problem.
What happens often in the chemistry there, it seems, I mean, I remember with the first debate between Al Gore and George W. Bush, Gore got kind of condescending and, you know, know-it-all, and so there was much more sympathy for then-Governor of Texas,
right.
Bush.
Again, TV's a tricky medium, and a lot depends on tone. You know, remember famously that the people who listened over the radio to the very first presidential debate thought Nixon had won.
And then they saw that 12 o'clock shadow.
Right. And the people who watched it thought Kennedy had won. It was absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
If I were a media producer, I think it would be fun to in these upcoming debates, put some people in a room and just feed them the audio, and then contrast the reaction, see if their impression of who won differed from the people who actually watched it.
Talking again with Chris Buckley, his new book is Supreme Courtship. It's a novel. It is out and has already received many accolades. I know you have many readers who like to play the Romana Clay game, and we were just talking about Biden in that context. Silvio Santamaria, obviously, is
does he remind
fairly
you
transparent. But who's the husband of Pepper, Buddy Bixby? He's just nobody, huh?
Well,
prototype in mind?
No. He's, you know, it's funny. People are often disappointed when you tell them, I made that character up out of whole cloth. They're kind of wanting you to say, oh, no, that's really based on, you know, so-and-so. But his name is Buddy, and he's
Buddy
sort of
Bixby.
Buddy Bixby, and he's a sort of a composite. He's Pepper's TV producer husband, and Courtroom 6 is his sort of class act. His other shows are reality shows. One is called G.O., which is the medical term for grotesque obese. It's, you know, the 700-pound people who fuse with their sofas. And the other is called a show called Jumpers, which is, security, consists of security camera footage of people leaping off bridges. So Pepper is very much his sort of class act, and he's very resentful when she accepts the president's invitation to go to Washington and sit on the Supreme Court.
But she has better ratings in the Congress, and that's really what matters.
Well, pretty much everyone has better ratings than the Congress. I think the Congress's approval ratings are actually currently in single digits.
I think that's right.
Yeah. About 8%.
And one thinks about, for example, the popularity of a phenomenon like Oprah when you're writing about Pepper, just how much she brings to this presidential campaign.
Sure. Apparently she is... Oprah is to... I suppose her influence on politics is as felt as her influence in the book world. If Oprah Winfrey made John Steinbeck a best-selling author 2 years ago.
Speaking of John Steinbeck, do you feel sometimes that being a satirist, or lampooner, or parodist, or however, a novelist, of course, but in those subgenres, that it maybe gives you a little bit of the Rodney Dangerfield? You've won this Washington
absolutely.
Irving Literary Award, but...
Yeah. No, absolutely. It's pretty much you sort of sit at the children's table, I think, if you write...
Like sci-fi writers, maybe, or something?
Well...
Or potboiler writers?
God, I like to think, I'm one notch up the food chain from Harlequin romances.
I'm being satiric here.
I think there is... it's funny. P.J. O'Rourke, my buddy P.J. O'Rourke said, anyone can draw a crowd by saying, I have cancer, but try doing 5 minutes of stand-up. I think there is a presumption that comic literature is sort of second-class citizenship. And yet, I'm not comparing myself, let me emphasize, I'm not comparing myself to any of these people, but, the enduring works, if not the enduring work of American literature, it could be called a comic novel by Mr. Samuel Clemens, called Huckleberry Finn.
Well, and think about Lucky Jim getting a little more contemporary and the impact
by
Kingsley
sure.
Amis. And we're talking with Chris Buckley, and we're going to open up our phone lines, an opportunity for you to talk to Chris Buckley or to join our conversation. We welcome your calls. You can dial in right now, toll free, 866-733-6786, and that'll work whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Again, it's toll free, 866-733-6786, or send an email to forum@kqed.org. You're listening to Forum, and I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour with Chris Buckley. His books include The White House Mess, Wet Work, and Thank You for Smoking. He's former chief speechwriter to then-Vice President George H.W. Bush, and since 1989, he's been founder and editor-in-chief of Forbes FYI magazine. His newest novel is called Supreme Courtship. Are you going to be appearing anywhere in the Bay Area for people who...
All over the Bay Area. The Bay Area is going to be good and sick of me by the time this tour is over. I'm at the Commonwealth Club at noon today, and then I'm at the Commonwealth Club in Silicon Valley at 7 o'clock.
Yeah, that's good for fans that's of a, yours
that's
to
a,
know.
That's a lot of Commonwealth. A
lot of Commonwealth.
A lot of Commonwealth.
Well, we're inviting you to join this conversation again, and I remind you that we'll go to your calls here forthwith, but the toll-free number, should you care to join the program, is 866-733-6786, or you can send an email to forum@kqed.org. And Mark from Dublin, that is our own East Bay Dublin. Good morning.
Yes. Hi, Chris and Michael. You've conjured up the memories of Dan Quayle, and I think this is particularly appropriate with the nomination of Sarah Palin. She either strikes me as the male version of Dan Quayle, or perhaps Dan Quayle strikes me as the female version of Sarah Palin.
I think she's better looking, but I think we may be back in Dan Quayle land. You know, as a tactical maneuver, it was rather shrewd of old McCain. I was sort of hoping that he would not nominate someone like Mitt Romney or
Joe Lieberman.
Apparently,
Tom Ridge.
From what I read, he wanted to nominate Joe Lieberman and was told he could not.
I think what's happened, and you're more of a Washington, well, not an insider, but you know this territory a lot better than I do. What I think seemed to have happened was Steve Schmidt's gotten a hold of him, hasn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. As a result, the McCain that was so appealing, you know, the McCain that we like, the maverick, has sort of disappeared, and he seems to have become just sort of another presidential candidate. Apparently, the reporters on the campaign plane the other day, when he got on, began chanting, "Bring back Mac, bring back Mac."
I thought things changed when he went to Lynchburg and met with Jerry Falwell. That was a key moment for change.
There's just such a craving for authenticity right now. That just, you know, what has happened is he has become, alas, inauthentic, and that's the more's the pity.
Also, these are the same people that did him in South Carolina, aren't
they? I know. It's mind-boggling.
Timothy, join us. Good morning.
Hi there, Michael. Hi there, Mr. Buckley.
Hello, Timothy.
I want to share with you, I don't know if you were at the Yale-Harvard game in 1988 in New Haven, but it was a very, very cold, cold day, and I was visiting my friend who went to Yale at the time, and we finally got to the stadium. It was freezing, and we were all drinking, and we got a little toasted, very drunk and rambunctious, and some guys from the class of 68 said, "The last time we saw guys as messed up and crazy as you guys, it was the son of the new president." And this was the third Saturday in November of 88.
A friend of mine who was at, where did he go to boarding school, W? It was Andover. Andover. And this friend of mine is now one of the leading cancer surgeons in America. And his memory of W is sitting in front of him during French class and being pelted with spitballs. So, you know, I'll say this about Bush: there was when he ran in 2000 I think it was Frank Bruni did a big profile in the New York Times of W's Yale years. And when he was inducted into DEEC, the fraternity that Michael, my kind host here, reminds me Dan Quayle was also a member of, there were about 60 inductees in an incoming group of DEEC. And the typical inductee knew the names of about three or four other fellow inductees. W knew the names of all of them. He had memorized the class book.
It's a good politician. He had nicknames for all of them, too.
The early inklings of the politician.
They had DEEC at Yale? I thought that he was just a bonesman.
No, he was a member of the fraternity DEEC, which was, you know...
Yale was all about the eating clubs or no?
No, the eating clubs are Princeton.
Well, I mean, my friend, my cousin was, you remember a secret society. That was the big club you wanted.
Yeah, I've heard of that institution.
Timothy, good to hear from you, and thank you for the call. Well, you know, when I think about his Yale days, our president, I think about him out there with pom-poms and cheerleading. Well,
that actually was, wasn't that Andover?
Was that no? Maybe it was Andover.
I think he was the head cheerleader at Andover.
Judy's going to look it up.
My W scholar biographical scholarship may be a little dusty. He may well have been a Yale cheerleader, but well, that was his skill. Let's face it. You know, his skills were sort of people wise. You know what? You know, in thinking about our current president, I would say this. That there are two basic components to his psychological makeup. He is, by his own profession, a born-again Christian. He is, by his own admission, a recovering alcoholic. Now, if I said to you, Michael, my friend Timothy is going to join us in about 10 minutes, but let me just tell you two things about Timothy. He is a born-again Christian and a recovering alcoholic. You would know a lot about Timothy.
Which gets us back to satire, because you know a lot about Washington, you know a lot about the political figures there, and it's great grist for your mill. And the question is, how hard-hitting, you know, there's Juvenalian satire, there's Swiftian satire, I don't want to get too academic here, but how hard-hitting and instructive do you want your satire to be?
Well, I have been criticized many times, and in prominent publications like the New York Times, for not being mean enough. Mordecai Rickler went after one of my books, said, you know, this is... it's sort of too much. There's too much fun in here. A really good satire, he said, should leave blood on the floor.
Which he could do, by the
Which
way.
Which he could do.
Richler
was
very good at that.
But that's not my style. I try. I do honestly try to make the serious point every now and then. But I consider. You know, people say to me sometimes, "Do you consider yourself a social critic? Do you consider yourself?" I consider myself an entertainer.
You're a humorist. You mentioned Twain. Twain is a humorist.
Well, though not putting myself in his category.
It's a good template.
But I'm an entertainer. I try to make people laugh, and I try to write a decent English sentence. That's really about it.
Your father was certainly. Major force in making you write a good English.
He was a tough grader. He was encouraging, but oh gosh, you know, my book before this one was a book called Boomsday, and I sent it to him, and the only response I got back was a P.S. of an email, and he said, "Sorry, this one didn't work for me."
Ooh,
ooh, but tell me what you really think.
But he. From all appearances and from everything you've said, was really a loving and attentive father.
Yeah. To be sure. But you know, great men are complex organisms. There are many rooms in their mansion.
Are you with, say, those conservatives who still say that the last of the great conservatives was Ronald Reagan, and we haven't seen his like and may not see his like again, that sort of thing?
Well, it hasn't been that long, historically speaking, since Reagan left the national stage, 20 years ago. You know, in the subspecies aeternitatis, that's not too long a time. I think there's probably a yearning for Reagan, the nostalgia sets in. But people like that don't come along every 20 years.
Well, you even had people like Limbaugh and more extreme versions, Ann Coulter, saying vote for Hillary Clinton because McCain is not conservative enough, and maybe 4 years later we'll have the Ronald Reagan redux.
I saw that, and I suppose there's the argument. I seem to be relying on a lot of my father's expressions, the French reculer pour mieux sauter, to step back in order better to leap forward.
Oh, yeah.
So I think there it. He was asked, my dear old dad. A year or so ago, what he thought of the current state of conservatism, and he put it in a very WFB way. He said he thought that it had become slothful and was in need of repristination. And I think that's hard to disagree with.
And he did say slothful rather than slothful.
He said slothful.
Yes. Let me bring some more callers on. Paul, good morning. You're on.
Good morning. Well, I have a couple of minor corrections. One is I'm actually from Dublin, and Robert Briscoe was a man, not a woman. And it was not surprising that Dublin had a Jewish mayor because they've had a Jewish community for 400 years. Now, the other aspect is everybody talks about W, you know, and his father, but I actually see W as the product of his mother. So I'll leave it at that, and you can think about it.
Well, I think you're quite right, Paul. He was what I do know is that he's much closer to his mother when his mother, and that goes back to an episode when he was very young. You may recall that George and Barbara Bush's daughter, Robin, died of leukemia very sadly at age, she was 6 years old, and this was in the early 50s. And Mrs. Bush, Barbara, went into a depression, as is not surprising, and it was her then a 6 or 7 year old son, George, who jollied her out of that depression, apparently he was a great teaser. And so they became very close. Barbara Bush, whom I love, she's a very tough lady. I mean, this is a very tough Yankee. And he has, and she's, you know, she will tell you exactly what's on her mind. So I think you're quite right that he is more like his mother than his father. But that doesn't preclude the competition, the competitiveness with his father.
Now, on the question of the Supreme Court, you know, when Bill Clinton was president, Ted Kennedy and Orrin Hatch, who were both on the Senate Judiciary Committee, they got together and they sat down and they made a list of people that would be acceptable to both. And Orrin Hatch actually was a great admirer of Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer. And that's why they went on. They weren't compromise candidates. They were people who were acceptable to everybody, and which is a better system than, say, the Republicans sticking Clarence Thomas on the Supreme Court just because, quote, his skin color.
Well, no argument there, or as the law would say, nolo contendere.
And we thank Paul for his call. Speaking about mothers and sons, as we were just a moment ago with Barbara Bush, you know, as the son of a great man and a man who was very much in the spotlight, you're often asked, obviously, about your father. But your mother was, cut quite a figure in her life. Some of it, an exceptional woman who's been identified probably a little bit narrowly as a socialite, I think, hasn't she?
My mother was a remarkable woman. She was from Vancouver, Canada. She always said that I'm just a simple girl from the backwoods of British Columbia. Henry Kissinger at her memorial service said, if Pat Buckley was a simple girl from the backwoods of British Columbia, I would tremble to meet a sophisticated woman from the backwoods.
It's a dead-on imitation.
British Columbia.
Yeah, no, very well done. You are an entertainer. You're doing imitations, too.
I do my best. She was a remarkable lady, my dear mom.
And strong.
Strong. Oh, boy.
Tough
boy.
Like Barbara Bush, yeah.
Well, in very...
different way.
Yeah, very... Oh, no. She could... I mean, she could, you know... I'd seen her, you know, decapitate people, you know, right, left, and center. But she was something out of sort of Noel Coward, really. You know, she was a truly remarkable woman. I lost them both within about 10 months of each other. I've actually written a book about that, coming out next May.
Uh-huh. About both your parents?
Yeah, it's a memoir of losing your parents within a year. And these were, you know, with all respect to every set of parents in the world who were wonderful and distinct in their own ways, William F. and Pat Buckley were larger-than-life people. And so, and I'm an only child. Very often, if you're an only child, the experience of parenthood is very intensely felt. So anyway, I've written a book about it, and it's called Losing Mom and Pop.
And you have children?
I do. I have a 20-year-old daughter at the College of Charleston and a 16-year-old son named Connor, who's actually named after his grandfather. He's William Connor Buckley, but I didn't want to saddle him with being William F. Buckley the third, so we call him Connor.
And have you kept the Catholic faith?
No,
your father
alas, I have misplaced it.
I think, are we getting clarity on
no, well, no. It's a big topic, and I don't mean to start pronouncing on agnosticism. My friend Christopher Hitchens has written a very good book about all this, and I'll refer you to that very good book.
You can actually listen to a broadcast on that book in there, our archives. We did an hour with Christopher Hitchens on his book.
I bet it was lively.
It's always lively Hitchens.
He is sui generis. There is no other Christopher Hitchens. He's a very great writer and a very great thinker. You have in Christopher Hitchens sort of, you know, very often you get the superb intellect and very often you get the superb stylistic ability. In Christopher, you get both. And that's very rare.
You also get somebody who has really antagonized both the left and the right to such a great degree.
Yeah, and who's made a remarkable trajectory. I mean, I've known Christopher for over 30 years, and when I knew him, he was, you know, a Molotov cocktail-throwing lefty, and he's now, you know, become the great proponent of our adventure in Iraq. So who'd have thunk?
Judy, you did find out that that Bush was a Yale cheerleader. Judy's saying Yale cheerleaders are asking, why haven't any member of Bush's cheerleading squad come forward and verified that he actually attended practice and the games?
Well, I'm glad we got that cleared up.
Important point.
Very important point.
And we'll go to Alex. Alex, thanks for waiting. Join us.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm curious about how does a Harvard MBA qualify for a person to be handling a financial crisis?
Are you talking about W?
I'm talking about our current president.
Yeah. Well, I don't see him doing much handling of this current crisis, do you? It seems to be Mr. Bernanke and Mr. Paulson.
Well, that's probably positive. Okay. The question is what does a Harvard MBA get you?
Well...
I think you've stumped our entertainer here.
I'm stumped.
Really get you
I don't know what I mean. There are, gosh, isn't Fred Smith of FedEx a Harvard MBA? He was, by the way, a classmate of W's. So I guess you get some really good economic stuff from Harvard MBA, and then you get some other stuff.
It opens doors.
Certainly opens doors.
Here's Jim listening to us in Chicago. He says, would your guest please comment on the issue of intellectual curiosity in the current political campaigns? Is the ability of one to think independent of one's emotions a lost cause in the public forum? Even more scary to me is the idea that only the intellectual elite use their brains in this way, and apparently they're all liberals. I'm supporting Obama as the lesser of two evils only because he appears to have the capacity to ground himself intellectually before weighing political considerations. Frankly, anyone who can't do that shouldn't be in power.
Well, I think that's not a question. I think that's a very well-put statement. I've read Obama's books, and I have been struck by how good a writer he is. I would be tempted to vote for him on those grounds alone, because someone who writes that well also, I think, thinks clearly. Now, Mr. Obama is left-wing. I am not left-wing, but I am probably going to vote for him on the grounds of his thoughtfulness. My hope being that once he inherits this mess, and it's going to be a mess, he inherits a country at war and in its worst financial crisis since 1929. God, are you really sure, Mr. Obama, you want this job? That his instincts and his thoughtfulness will lead him towards creative, non-ideological solutions. If he comes in and simply adopts a standard left-wing agenda of raising taxes and increasing tariffs, then I think we're going to be in very deep trouble.
But when the listener brings up his intellect, a lot of memory goes back to the Adlai Stevenson effect. You know, you get an intellectual president, and you don't necessarily get good decision making. In fact, there's been some stuff recently reported in the newspapers, since we're talking about W's life at Harvard and Yale, that Obama, when he was heading up the Harvard Law Review, some of his friends apparently have gone on record as saying we liked him and he was a good guy, but mm-hmm. he wasn't great at making decisions.
No, that's the intellectual can be crippled by the, on the one hand, on the other. He has not, in his public pronouncements, Obama recently has not really shown any clear solution to these problems. His default position is, well, you know, we really have to think about this. I'm going to quote something my dear old dad once said, and it's one of his most famous lines, that he would rather be governed by the first 2,000 names in the Boston telephone directory than by the faculty of Harvard.
One of his many memorable lines.
Yeah.
Talking, by the way, with Christopher Buckley. He'll be at the Commonwealth Club, a couple Commonwealth Clubs, at San Francisco's Commonwealth Club at noon today, and in San Jose at the Commonwealth Club there at 7 p.m. His book is called Supreme Courtship, and it is out and available. And I want to remind you that you're listening to Forum on KQED Radio, and this is Pledge Week for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support this radio station, simply go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. Well, here's a listener up in Cambridge, Massachusetts, Liz, who says, I'm a merchant mariner and loved your book, Steaming to Bambula. It's hilarious. It captures shipping out to a T. I was happy to get a copy, as it's now out of print. Would you care to comment further on your time at sea?
Well, bless you, Liz. my very first book was a book called, Steaming to Bambula. I worked on a Norwegian tramp freighter the year between high school and college, and then 10 years later went back onto an American ship spent 78 very long days tramping back and forth across the North Atlantic, usually in storms, between the Gulf Coast and Bremerhaven. And I wrote a book which was a portrait of this ship and its crew. And I'm very, very happy to hear from Liz, and I wish her good winds and following seas.
Well, one associates your father with a lot of sailing.
Oh, yeah. If you Google My Old Man and the Sea, you will come across a piece that I wrote about my sailing experiences with my dear old dad, including one memorable night in October of 97 when I arrived for a prearranged Friday night sail on Long Island Sound. He had a 36-foot sailboat, and there was a northeast gale raging. And when my train pulled into the Stamford train station, I looked out, and it was like the scene in The Wizard of Oz. You know, houses were being blown away, trees, cows. My dad was sort of holding on to a stanchion, and I when the door to the train opened, I was literally blown back into the train. I sort of crawled out of the train on all fours, and he greeted me saying, well, we should have a brisk sail. And I said, we're going out in this? He said, oh, sure, why not? The answer is, we always went out in it, but we went out for a pleasure sail in a northeast gale in 55-mile-an-hour winds. It was, you know, great men are different from you and me. Well, you're a great man, Michael, but
hardly.
Great men are different from you and me, as F. Scott Fitzgerald might have said.
And, of course, Hemingway's retort... Yes,
they
have more money.
They have
right?
more money.
And we go to Knoxville, Tennessee. Kevin, join us. Good morning.
Hi there. Well, I was absolutely shocked to discover that Mr. Buckley writes satire. I lived in D.C. for 3 years, and it was the most strangely artificial place I've ever been in my entire life. And I recently, about 3 weeks ago, made a Christopher Buckley run to the bookstore to see if there was anything new out. And I didn't see his latest, but I did pick up Boomsday and brought that back and read it. And reading through it, I was struck once again at how accurately he captures the culture of Washington, D.C. It's just extraordinarily accurate.
Well, thank you. What were you doing in D.C. for those years, Kevin?
I was programming computers out in Centerville in North Virginia.
Yeah,
that
I
sounds
know that, is.
That sounds suspiciously as though you must have been working
for the CIA.
CIA. Well, the old programming computers in Centerville, eh?
No, actually, I was one of those hordes of contract programmers that people hire for this, that, and the other thing, because nobody actually wants to pay benefits. So.
Well, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for the comment, Kevin. I appreciate that.
Do you read other Saturday? Who do you like? You read Carl Hiaasen or anything?
Yeah, I just listened to Carl Hiaasen's novel Skinny Dip, and there just no one does it better than Carl. The two best humorists. I think the two of the best humorists currently writing are Floridians, Dave Barry and mm-hmm. Carl Hiaasen. And I think Florida is to them as rich a breadbasket as Washington is to me. The other...
So Barry's never written any fiction, I don't think, has he?
I'm sorry?
Barry hasn't written any fiction. Yes, he has.
Oh. I am happy to correct you on that. He wrote a wonderful, very funny novel called Big Trouble, which was made into an absolutely hilarious movie with Tim Allen, Rene Russo, Stanley Tucci, and Tom Sizemore. So if you get Netflix, Netflix, is Netflix a transitive verb?
That's a good question.
You're a PhD.
Yeah, well,
come on.
Not in grammar. We've got time for another quick call. Tate from Richmond, good morning.
Hey there.
Hi.
I just wanted to commend your guest on what he said with respect to the what satire functions as. He said, someone else said it's supposed to leave blood on the floor, and I think that there's a component of making fun of it, and hopefully it's for everyone and not at the expense of someone else.
Well said. And
thank you
for that call.
Thank you.
And it's been a pleasure to be with you, Chris. Thank you so much for joining us.
Michael, thanks for having me on, and may I make a pledge?
Of course.
May I make a $100 pledge?
There's a $100 pledge
right,
from Christopher Buckley.
Right.
We thank you for that.
You take American Express?
We commend you. Of course we do. And you can meet him today at the Commonwealth Club again at... here at San Francisco at noon and in San Jose at 7 o'clock. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and hours repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Thank you for joining us on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.